colleagues joining on the panelists online. Okay, I think we're ready to make a start. Welcome everybody joining us in Brussels in the room. Welcome to our distinguished panel joining us in the room and online. We'll say something more about that in a moment. I'm very glad to be hosting this event on what I think really are three of the key issues at the moment in global policy: development, trade and climate. This event is falling almost halfway between the launch of the EU's carbon border adjustment mechanism and the 28th Conference of the Parties on Climate, which will meet at the start of December. So it seems a perfect moment to consider these issues. And I guess we're 6 weeks into the transition period of the EU carbon border adjustment mechanism. And I'm sure most people joining us will be familiar with that. Importers of certain material will need to pay the EU carbon price on embedded emissions. But this is expected to have important impacts on lower income economies. And some of CGD's work has highlighted this in the case of Mozambique, for example, which has heavy reliance on exports of aluminium to the EU. And potentially they could be paying a significant share of their economic production in the carbon border adjustment mechanism if they can't find alternative markets. So I guess the context for this as well is that lower income countries have got tiny carbon footprints of their own, at least in terms of per head emissions. The lowest income economies have less than a ton per head. Whereas those of us in the EU and the UK are emitting, you know, at least 5 tons per head and often more if you account for wider emissions. And of course, EU industries have some access to subsidies to help with the transition, whereas in lower income countries, those subsidies are not widely available. And so there's that disadvantage as well. So what I hope we're going to talk about in this panel is both the impact of CBAM on developing countries, how they are responding, and to also hear about any EU plans to support that response. We have an excellent panel with us, so this will be almost the last you'll be hearing from me. So let me introduce them briefly. We have Maria Elena Scoppio, welcome, Director of Indirect Taxation and Tax Administration in the Directorate General for Tax and the Customs Union in the European Commission. And Maria was also a member of the cabinet of Commissioner Gentiloni, covering wider tax issues. So this is, I think, not new to her, and I'm really glad to have her perspective on the panel. We have David Luke, who's Professor in Practice and Strategic Director at the Firoz Laji Institute for Africa at the London School of Economics. Many of you will know David. He has a very distinguished career in trade policy, including at the Commission for Africa, and at UNDP. So great to have you here, David. Joining us online is Rim Berahab. Rim is a senior economist at the Policy Centre for the New South, which is based in Morocco. She's currently working on themes related to energy issues and the impact on economic growth, and has published a study on CBAM. So great to have you here, Rim. And last on our panel is David Kleiman, who's a visiting fellow at Bruegel and is based in Brussels, but is unfortunately struck down by COVID, so he's joining us remotely. But David has very deep expertise in trade. He's worked on it 15 years, looking at the different dimensions of legal policy and institutions of the EU and international trade. And his current work is focused on the nexus of climate and trade. So I think we've got a great range of perspectives. If you're joining us online, you can pose your questions through Slido using the hashtag CBAM, and I'll pick those up here and put those to our panel. But other than that, let's get to it. David, maybe I can start with you. So your recent report with the Africa Climate Foundation found that the impact on African economies might be just under 1% of GDP of the CBAM. And even though that sounds relatively small, I think that amounts to something like 3 times the EU's development cooperation budget. So you've You've argued for there to be an adjustment period, an appropriate finance for lower income countries. So can you tell us what that would mean in practice?
Firstly, let me say thanks to the Centre for Global Development in Bruxelles for hosting us at this discussion here this afternoon. Delighted to be here. Yes, we have undertaken a study that looked at how the CBAM would affect African economies. What you've just referenced is part of the findings. It's quite an intricate study that looked at several scenarios, different carbon prices, and the implications of all of that. And that, yes, African economies, although, as you rightly point out, small producers, but nonetheless, the effect would be quite significant on their economies. Yes, there are ways of mitigating that, and a longer transition period could be one way of dealing with that. But I think CBAM raises a much broader question about, how you can adjust and so on. It raises a question about the role of climate in international trade, and I think it's a very important question, because according to some estimates, international trade accounts for about 20% of GHG emissions. But I think also it requires international cooperation as to how you deal with this. I think one of the problems of the CBAM is that it's a unilateral measure. It has been developed unilaterally and has not taken into account the established principles that govern climate discussions, including common but differentiated responsibilities, respective capacities, and so on. At the same time, these countries, and I'll end with this, not to go too long on this, but at the same time, these countries all committed to doing their part, as is required under the Paris Agreement, through the nationally determined contributions and so on. So you just wonder whether other approaches could not be used to arrive at the same effect, including looking at the level of ambition in nationally determined contributions, looking at how to support the ambition expressed in the NDCs to be met, and so on. So I think there are other ways other than just simply taking CBAM for granted that is a done deal, and what is required now is just adjustment. I think it's a much broader question than that. And my last point on this is that the actual effect of the CBAM on global GHG emissions is quite underwhelming. I think all the studies have shown that it's less than 1% of the effect will be less than 1% of on GHG emissions. Our own study, in one of our scenarios with carbon at priced at 40 euros a ton, actually said that the CBAM will reduce emissions by just 0.002%. So the effect is underwhelming. So you just wonder whether the diplomatic fallout, the political fallout of this, is really worth the effort. But the premise of your question, I think, is not just a question of adjusting to the CBAM. I think we need to look at how you could use international cooperation to arrive at the same destination, so to say. So let me stop here. I'm sure we'll come back and I could elaborate on some of these points.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I mean, I'm struck by, I feel personally there's a balance here. I mean, you in principle, you'd want to approach these things multilaterally, but the urgency obviously makes a case for our countries and regions acting. And so, I mean, I guess some of us are pleased to see the EU, taking this action to tackle the leakage of emissions. And I mean, maybe that takes us neatly onto you, Maria. And, you know, at the African Climate Summit last September, when African leaders met, they also emphasised kind of a multilateral approach and common but differentiated responsibilities, which is a principle of the UN system and internationalism. So could you tell us a bit about how you consulted with partners on the design of the CBAM? And I know the EU Parliament argued for there to be some redistribution of the revenues or some adjustment mechanism. Can you give us some insight into why that recommendation wasn't taken forward?
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me. First of all, I would like to say a couple of words and maybe also reply to what has just been said on CBAM, because CBAM, as you rightly said, is a measure to tackle carbon leakage. It's not a measure to reduce emissions. It's a measure to target carbon leakage, and is a measure that has triggered already a movement, a dynamic internationally, which is very noteworthy. So if we are considering CBAM as an element that whose objective should be to reduce emission, we are looking at the wrong side of it. Tackling carbon leakage is important because, as we all know, years ago we made the choice of ETS, and now free allowances after more than 10 years are supposed to be phased out. Therefore, in order to avoid that there is a relocation of production in a less stringent concerning environmental legislation countries, and then re-imported in Europe, we had to implement this measure, which is not a protectionist measure, it's not a tax, it's an environmental measure. But the most important aspect of that, and then I will come to your question, the most important aspect is that CBAM has just started in its transitional phase, which is going to be very long, almost 3 years. And we have already seen a number of initiatives growing everywhere. In the OECD, we have the inclusive framework for addressing climate change, and we have the Climate Club. We are talking now at the same level with a number of countries who totally ignored us until now, and they are interested in this system. Many dozens are thinking of applying a system like ETS and like CBAM, so to be on the same level playing field as Europe, but also in African countries. You would be surprised, or in Mozambique, there have been recent steps to green the production, and that is something that would never have happened probably without CBAM. For what concerns particularly those countries, and then I come to your question, CBAM does not look at countries. It targets goods, no matter where they come from. We don't have to forget that the EU is nonetheless one of, I think, the biggest contributor to greening policies in least developed countries, and will continue to do so. What we didn't do in the CBAM is to include an automatic system that would compensate, because that would have gone against the basic feature that I just mentioned. CBAM does not target countries, it targets goods. So in the CBAM regulation, it's not possible to make a distinction between the goods that are coming from a certain origin or another origin. This is the reason why we are tackling this issue in another part of the Commission, which is going to be the support to our partners who are still to develop a bit more. And that is going to be done. That is going to be one of the things that we are going to look at during the transitional phase. We are working hand in hand with our colleagues in NIR and in INPA, that you may know are the DGs that are in charge of dealing with our neighboring countries and all the other countries in the world that need to be put into a special partnership with Europe. Therefore, yes, we did consult. We are aware of what could happen, but first, we consider that the dynamic that has been triggered by CBAM would not have been existing otherwise, and that is already something which you cannot quantify in terms of reduction of emissions, but it's massive, potentially. And second, we cannot technically put anything in the CBAM regulation because that would discriminate between goods. But of course, we are not blind, and we are thinking about it. Thanks.
Great, thank you. And I mean, I take your point as well on the dialogues that have started around, you know, carbon pricing, which I think are essential for the transition. Can I just ask you a brief follow up on working with your partners and what might happen there? I mean, Are you anticipating that there would be, you know, a material, the EU's budget for development is relatively fixed every 7 years. So are you envisaging a reallocation of that towards countries to help them with a transition, or towards countries that are coping with the worst effects of climate change? Is that what you might expect as a consequence of these discussions?
I'm only in charge of SEBA. I wouldn't know.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. So let's turn now to how countries are dealing with CBAM and perhaps some of the thinking that Marie has alluded to. So, Reem, I wonder if I could turn to you next. And you know, Morocco is a country which exports, I think, fertilizers to the EU in significant volumes, and so in the first round will potentially be quite impacted by the forthcoming CBAM. So, can you tell us a little bit about your work and what steps Morocco is taking to address those challenges, and maybe even any opportunities that you see from the introduction of the CBAM?
Thank you very much, Ian. I mean, it's a pleasure to be here with you today for this engaging conversation. I do wish I could be there in person, but prior commitments have me virtually connected, and I'm delighted we can connect this way. Now, as was mentioned before, when the CBAM was announced, it was of course welcomed by many countries, but it also sparked some concerns worldwide. In fact, one of our senior fellows at the Policy Center, who you may know, Uri Dadouche, and I conducted some research on this matter to better understand the mechanism, its implication for developing countries, and how to better prepare for it. Now, concerns about the CBAM were particularly prominent in developing economies, since the CBAM introduces significant complexities that, if left unaddressed, could jeopardize the already delicate foundation of the global trading system. Additionally, some developing countries viewed it as unfair, and their apprehension arises from the belief that without adequate support policies, particularly in terms of their energy transition and financing, CBAM could potentially widen the welfare gap between these nations and developed countries. Therefore, I think it is crucial for decision makers to grasp the intricacy of this mechanism and closely monitor recent development in order to better prepare for it. Now, with that admittedly lengthy introduction, I'd like to shift my attention to Morocco. And I think that in the grand scheme of things, I believe that Morocco sees CBAM as an opportunity, and this holds true. However, it also presents a set of challenges that demand our attention. And I'll break it down step by step. Now, Morocco is directly impacted by the CBAM, as you just mentioned, because Europe stands as its principal trading partners for, in recent years, it accounted for nearly 65% on average of Morocco's export. And the concerns lie in the fact that several key industries such as automotive, aeronautics, textile, fertilizers, as well as agri-food play a vital role in Morocco's industrial landscape and could potentially face challenges in terms of export competitiveness in a more decarbonized world. However, when we zoom in on the near term and specifically consider the categories targeted by the CBAM, we observe that Morocco has a relatively lower reliance on export of these products to the EU compared to other countries. In fact, in our study back in 2021, we found out that Morocco's CBAM export made up only 3% of its total export to the EU. However, within this subset, fertilizers are a significant component and accounts for a remarkable 78%. Despite that, I think that Morocco's government, as I said, sees the entry into force of the CBAM as an opportunity because it could allow Moroccan manufacturers to expedite their decarbonization efforts, thus enhancing their competitiveness in the process. And I think that the favorable conditions are already in place, and Morocco didn't wait for the CBAM to initiate its decarbonization journey. This journey actually started back in 2009 when Morocco adopted a proactive energy strategy led by the Ministry of Energy Transition. And the primary focus was on increasing the utilization of renewable energies. And by the end of 2022, the strategy resulted in renewable energy representing about 38% of the total installed electrical capacity in the country. And with the recent introduction of roadmaps for green hydrogen and biomass, coupled with the pending European CBAM, I think the initial targets for installed capacity have been raised to 52% by 2030. So I think that Morocco's key asset is its abundant renewable energy potential, which include wind, solar, and hydropower. And thanks to its geographical advantages, Morocco can produce some of the most cost-effective renewable energy globally. And this serves as a compelling economic incentive for businesses to align with climate change mitigation objectives. And today we see that some major industrial groups in Morocco, like the OCP Group, which is the state-owned enterprise that produces phosphate and fertilizers, is largely committed to this decarbonization approach. Now, despite these opportunities, I mentioned earlier some challenges, and I think that they need to be acknowledged because while Morocco has made substantial efforts to develop renewable energies, a significant portion of its electricity is still generated from thermal sources, including coal and gas, and this results in a heavy carbon footprint compared to European counterparts. So, for instance, Moroccan electricity emissions peaked at around 750 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour, compared to around 180 in Spain and I think 50 in France. And this is not only the case for electricity alone. In a recent study that Yuri and I made in 2021, we found out that even though Morocco's CO2 emission per capita are a fraction of that of the EU and its biggest trade partners like the US and China, Morocco's CO2 emission per unit of GDP, also called as emission intensity, are about 20% higher than that of the EU. And Moroccan industry appears to be much more CO2 intensive than the EU, making it especially exposed to the CBAM since the scheme's primary focus is presently on this sector. And three main factors account for the high emission intensity of Morocco the Moroccan industry compared to the EU, namely the sources of primary energy, efficiency in the use of energy, as well as laws and regulation. But to overcome these challenges, so Morocco needs to accelerate its energy transition and extend it throughout its entire industrial landscape. And the regulatory framework has been updated over the years to encourage the development and expansion of renewable energy for power generation, with a particular emphasis on granting the industry access to affordable and clean energy. Beyond the challenges within Morocco, I think that there are also some challenges related to the broader concept of the CBAM itself. Perhaps this point doesn't apply to Morocco, but more broadly to developing countries, because the absence of country exemption was a concern for many developing countries. And they fear that CBAM might penalize them, even though under, for instance, the common but differentiated responsibility principle under the Paris Agreement. The intent is that the carbon price or the carbon price implicit in tax and regulatory measures can be lower in some least developed countries. Additionally, the CBAM's implication for the World Trade Organization and concerns about retaliations of some developing countries are points of contention. Because as more countries adopt CBAM, agreements on modalities, product coverage, as well as national scheme will vary, and carbon border taxes, whether based on ETS or other schemes, may eventually vary not only by country of destination and by product, but also by country of origin and by firm, which potentially makes it a departure from the WTO's most favored nation principle. Another notable aspect is the exclusion of agriculture from the CBAM, despite substantial EU subsidies in this sector. And this omission has raised questions about fairness, as agricultural exporters from many developing countries may argue that the ETS and CBAM do not address emission in agriculture, potentially undermining their efficacy. So maybe I'll stop here for now. And I think that given all these opportunities and challenges, I do believe that effective communication is crucial to avoid misunderstanding regarding CBAM, and support from the EU and other countries in the form of increased partnerships and collaborations is equally as essential in order to navigate the CBAM landscape effectively and help us move towards a more decarbonized future.
Great. Thanks, Rim. And it's really nice to see some, you know, practical examples of how concepts like the emissions intensity of GDP are kind of making it into, I wouldn't say, you know, common parlance, but but at least being more commonly discussed. And it was interesting as well to hear some of the challenges you raised being some of the ones that we've got on the agenda to talk about. And that takes us to David Kleiman. And David, I hope you're feeling all right with COVID. I'm so pleased you could join us remotely. I mean, you've briefed the European Parliament on CBAM, and you've been thinking about this for a while. So, you know, the principle of common and differentiated responsibilities that RIM raises, some countries have concerns about that at the WTO and whether CBAM aligns with it. If you were in a trade ministry in a country affected by CBAM, what would you be considering in terms of your response, and what would be the issues?
Thank you so much, Ian, for having me with you. Sorry, I can't be there with you today. As you said, I'm decided to play the safe for obvious reasons. But I'm very delighted to be on this stellar panel, and thank you for allowing me to make a contribution to this discussion. To your question, I think, you know, what we've heard from the previous speakers, you know, is really, you know, the main message here is that CBAM has a relatively small trade effect on average, at least at the outset. So, but at the same time, I think we have, you know, various exporters and exporting countries that are heavily exposed even at the early stages. And you've named some of them beforehand already. Now, how can governments mitigate these effects other than sort of taking a confrontational stance, you know, challenges at the WTO, which might not be such a bad idea after all, but you know, sort of there is perhaps a more constructive way of engaging with the reality that is the CBAM. And I wonder where I would suggest that perhaps we can, you know, distinguish between three categories of mitigation efforts on behalf of affected countries. And, you know, the first one that I would suggest is really, and this is relatively common knowledge, but perhaps helps us to think through a little bit of different strategies, is, you know, the reduction of companies' compliance costs by putting in place fit for purpose domestic infrastructure for domestic, for emission monitoring, reporting and verification. So for instance, governments can introduce reporting and monitoring requirements for sectoral emissions, transmit data to the European Commission to avoid producers being subject to unfavorable CBAM default values, help to build exporter capacity for internal carbon accounting that meets the regulatory requirements of the CBAM, promote accreditation of domestically established verifiers, so that EU accredited verifiers don't have to go to, you know, cross you know, borders, travel to third countries to verify emissions and certify embedded emissions of in installations and products, etc. So that would be important. Governments can lobby the EU to use CBAM revenues, and, you know, just talked about this, to provide financial assistance to exporters to cover some of the cost of emission data verification. And more generally, governments can lobby the EU to ramp up capacity building programs for LDCs in support of the development of public and private carbon accounting infrastructures. So these are, you know, I think, you know, sort of mitigation efforts directly related to compliance with CBAM. Then we are entering a completely different ballgame. That is, in fact, the reduction of domestic emissions in CBAM sectors and of power generation, the scope 2 emissions, to reduce the CBAM charge. And arguably one of the best ways to do that, or most effective ways to do that, is to adopt a carbon price for CBAM sectors that can be credited under the CBAM upon export. So that would, as we've seen from a recent Indian proposal, you know, avoid handing over precious funds to the EU that could be better used to subsidize domestic industrial transformation domestically. But this overall is probably unlikely in the longer term to be sufficient to make a significant dent to emission abatement, in anticipation of what we will see is the broader proliferation of CBAM policies around the world. And for that, you know, one may consider lobbying OECD governments and institutions to ramp up conditional finance for decarbonization through just transition partnerships, greening aid for trade, the renewal of which is currently in deliberation, and other multilateral and bilateral programs. Now that brings me to the third bucket or category of mitigation efforts that is a bit more indirect, and that would be international cooperation on CBAM policies generally. And that is for countries and governments to engage in the relevant and inclusive forum has been named, the G7 club has been named, and relevant international organizations to advocate for coordination among countries that are contemplating CBAM policy implementation in the near or further future to reduce the trading costs that are associated with the sort of fragmentation of BCA regimes. So, these are just three categories to, perhaps help think about, so compliance costs immediately, then the decarbonization challenge, and international cooperation on CBAM policies more broadly. And let me leave it at that.
Super. Thanks, David. And that is a nice moment perhaps to plug that a blog published by my colleague Sam Pleak this morning, which looks at how many lower income countries actually have an operational carbon price, where the killer stat is of 70 lower income and lower middle income countries, only one has got an operational carbon price and only six have one under consideration. So I think it's quite a significant challenge. And I'm also pleased you brought up the example of India, actually. I wanted to ask Maria about this. So, I mean, I've only seen rumours of this or reports of this in the press at this moment, but I think the suggestion is that India might have an export tax which mirrors the CBAM and therefore enables them to raise the revenue to tax the carbon domestically. And I was interested whether, Maria, is it too soon for you to have seen that proposal? And does the Commission have a view of what it would prefer to see from implementing partner countries in terms of their response to the CBAM? Or are you agnostic between whether it's paid or whether there's a domestic carbon price implemented?
One basic feature of CBAM is to take into account the carbon price that has been paid in the country of origin, and that is offset from the certificates that have to be surrendered at the border. So it has to be effectively paid, and if it's on carbon, it's easier to calculate. That's clear. I didn't see myself precisely that proposal. I've heard about it. It's not the only country, as I mentioned before. And only this, I think, would be a great success.
Great, thank you. And David, can I just bring you in on this point? I'm particularly interested in the India proposal because I think my interpretation of it was that it was not necessarily a careful auditing of carbon in India's own exports, but more a broad-based export tax on the industries that would be affected by the CBAM. And I just wondered if you've seen it and whether you have a view on any of the WTO issues that it might need to watch out for.
I've not studied the Indian proposal closely, so I don't want to get too much into it. But it seems to me that it is one of these retaliatory responses that you're beginning to see emerge. But as I say, one needs to look at this more closely. But as has been said, it's also true to say that there are various forums, at least two important ones, which are looking at how international cooperation could be taken further. And I think Maria mentioned the G7 initiative, which could actually evolve into a G21. I've seen a report that the Brazilians, the incoming chair of the G20, are interested in looking at that. The OECD initiative also, I think, is an important forum for international cooperation on these matters. But I think we have to understand also the complexity of what we are talking about here, because you do have a different wide array of policy instruments, of carbon prices, of regulatory standards, of subsidies, and varying sectoral coverage, and so on. So I think it's true that CBAM has got all of us to think about these things, but it's a whole range of issues that now we need to look to see how best we can align on these on all of them. But it brings us back to the fact that unilateral measures can only go so far, that you do need to have some degree of international cooperation on these matters. And the point that you made, that only hardly any of the LDCs have any carbon pricing scheme, is indicative of the challenge for them. And whether indeed, in fact, that is something that should be a priority for them, or they should be looking at, as other countries have done, the clean energy transition and so on. So, but yeah, you know, I think there's scope for international cooperation. It's already happening. The technical work, the standards, and so on is ongoing. And I think that's promising in terms of trying to get everyone aligned at a certain level.
Thank you. So I've got two more quick questions for the panel, and then I'm going to open it up for discussion, because some of our panelists need to leave at 5 sharp. But David Clymer, I just wanted to pick up an issue that has emerged in this discussion so far about climate clubs. And I guess I'm torn on them. I mean, it makes sense for high income countries to be working together to tackle climate. But I also think it's odd that the high emitters would get together in some way and try and exclude, you know, lower emitters from their markets, as has been essentially suggested by the US. So I was interested in your take on climate clubs. And then Rim, before we finish, I'm just going to give you the heads up on your question, which is going to be, we talked a bit about the support that countries might expect from the EU and the financial resources. I just wonder whether Morocco will ask for anything from the EU in terms of financial or technical capacity support. So, David, to you first.
Thank you so much, Ian. So, you know, I think, you know, with the whole climate club discussion, we need to, it's perhaps good to gain a little bit of conceptual clarity, as in, you know, as you already mentioned, that, you know, the traditional concept of the climate club is obviously the proposal by William Nordhaus, you know, sort of creating a club among countries with high levels of mitigation that imposed a punitive tariff on the non-club members to prevent free riding. That, in my view, is a bit of an economist pipe dream. At least, the earlier versions of it, there's a number of problems with that approach. The most obvious ones are that there needs to be an agreement among the cooperating countries on an international target carbon price. We would have punitive unilateral tariffs that would be WTO illegal. It's very difficult to justify such an, you know, scheme that is projected at outside a decarbonization, or is looking at, or is targeting outside external decarbonization only. It would generate what we see right now in terms of CBAM and deforestation. If you talk to the EU colleagues, Commission colleagues at the mission to the WTO in Geneva, they will tell you that the political rift that is emerging, even with arguably well-designed policies that treat domestic producers and importers alike, there is tremendous tension, and doing so just, you know, for the outside world, just for external decarbonization, is another piece of dynamite, one would argue. And it would also arguably reinforce international economic inequities, especially when countries that are imposing those tariffs don't apply domestic carbon pricing and subsidize at the same time. So that, you know, is just a sort of an array of injustice and sort of disparate effects of such a scheme that one would argue is not recommendable for the cooperation that we would need in this transition. So arguably, this idea is dead. With minor exceptions, the G7 German G7 proposal has turned that debate a little bit around towards, you know, or it is a paradigm shift from a notion of a coercive rich countries club to an inclusive cooperation platform that can serve as an institutional infrastructure for cooperation regarding all sorts of policy instruments that relate to climate mitigation, including carbon pricing and carbon border adjustments. And I think, you know, and I don't want to extend this too much, but there are now some very interesting papers coming out sort of evaluating the inclusive forum as well as the G7 club or the global steel and aluminum arrangement negotiations as to whether these arrangements or these cooperation fora can advance objectives, legitimate objectives in regard of carbon border adjustments or the proliferation of carbon border adjustments. And Michael Mehling and colleagues have put out a recent paper, or are putting very soon out a paper that evaluates, assesses these fora along the lines of, you know, these legitimate objectives that are enhancement of transparency among different BCA instruments, development of shared objectives, best practices, promotion of comparability, alignment, interoperability of different BCA regimes, and generally the contribution to global climate ambition. And just as a little spoiler, and you should all read that paper when it comes out with climate strategies, the inclusive forum, due to its institutional strength and durability and the attainment of or at least the potential to attain various BCA cooperation objectives, scores very, very high. Whereas the G7 club proposal, lacks a bit of the institutional strength and infrastructure and durability, or at least there's uncertainty about it, which is why it scores slightly less. But then the GSA, which ranks badly across all categories, and let me stop here just to speak a bit, just to have mentioned a little bit of what these different cooperation fora that are not really traditional climate clubs should look at and may deliver in the future.
Right, thanks, David. We'll look forward to reading that, and thank you for sharing the headline spoiler. Rim, do you just want to tell us a little bit about what Morocco might expect from the EU in terms of support?
Yes, of course. So I think that the core of the issue lies in the fact that while opinions on the potential impact of the CBAM vary, there is a global or growing consensus that we need to find a balance between different interests. And the lessons shared, they teach us the importance of considering the broader implications of the CBAM and the necessity for multilateral solutions that drive decarbonization in international trade, because the goal here is to prevent potential trade conflicts between the EU and its trading partners, all while supporting developing nations in their energy transition journey. Now, before I dive into what EU support for countries like Morocco could entail, it's crucial to first identify the impact on Morocco and what measures Morocco can take at an initial step. Once this step is made, it could help us pinpoint the gaps that the EU can potentially fill. So how does the CBAM affect Morocco? I think that we can categorize these impacts into two broad categories, direct and indirect. And I spoke about it briefly earlier. They include considerations of costs, competitiveness, compliance requirements, potential adjustment within value chains, as well as heightened risk exposures along the value chain. And mitigating the impacts of CBAM on the Moroccan economy demands a proactive approach and a comprehensive response from the country. So the first order of business for Morocco is to scrutinize its list of goods that it trades with the EU in order to clearly identify those falling under the EU's CBAM regime. And this in-depth assessment helps pinpoint the specific sectors and products likely to be affected. And once these sectors are identified, it is essential to align roles or assign roles and responsibilities, because clarity in this regard ensures a coordinated and efficient response to these new measures. And the parties responsible need to identify the data requirements for CBAM compliance and model the cost implications for companies and their customers. And this assessment isn't just about financial significance, it's also about enabling the relevant stakeholders along the value chain to work together effectively on compliance activity. As I mentioned earlier, Morocco has made strides in strengthening and modernizing its regulatory framework for renewable energy. And more for companies that might not fully be prepared for the carbon tax deadline, especially among small and medium-sized businesses, there is a range of technical and financial support, both from the public and private sector. Now about the expectation of the EU support. I think that the EU is a valuable partner for Morocco, and this partnership should be strengthened to support Morocco's accelerated decarbonization efforts. And I think that Morocco has also a lot to offer to the EU in terms of the expertise that it has developed in the development of renewable energy. So I think that policymakers in Morocco should engage with their EU counterparts to deepen and fortify partnerships and support the decarbonization of the economy. And this could involve sharing knowledge and best practices, as well as developing joint projects and initiatives. But ultimately, I think the support is needed is mainly financial. So tools like the green value chain and the green economy financial facilities are already being set up by European partners with partner banks in Morocco, and through various programs initiated, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development is expected to release over 3.6 billion dirhams in green financing lines in Morocco by the end of 2025. Beside that, I think that providing financial support for energy efficiency measures in Morocco can also be very crucial. And another area where EU financial support could be valuable is the renovation of energy infrastructure to minimize energy losses, for instance, and adapt networks to electricity generated from renewable sources that could be, for instance, to the EU. But in conclusion, I think that it's all about collaboration and proactive measures, because with concerted efforts, we can navigate the challenges and seize the opportunities presented by the CBAM.
Nice to get the two-way collaboration in there and to hear some concrete examples of the financing that is already available with EBRD. David, you had a quick response, and then I'm going to open up to questions.
Privilege of peer reviewing the climate strategies paper that David Klein mentioned, and two things jumped at me, which I think we could also reference here. First is on institutional strength, that it did seem to me somewhat ironical that we already have the WTO, we have the UNFCCC, as well established institutions for international cooperation on these matters, and so that was one issue. The other one is that inclusion, of course, and the effort to bring in other countries into these discussions does not mean development. Inclusion and development are not the same things. And what I mean by this is that you do need to take into account development aspects, and so some of them we've already touched on in the course of this discussion. So inclusion is important, bringing other countries, but then on the substance, you have to focus also on the development effects and the mitigation strategies that go with that.
Thank you. So let me see if there's any questions in the room. I've got two online that I'm going to pose, which I think are mainly for you, Maria, as our commission guest. So let me pose those to you. I mean, so one is on the same theme that we've been talking about a little bit, on common but differentiated responsibilities, but I suppose with an emphasis on that featuring in the Paris Agreement. And you've argued that, you know, the CBAM doesn't discriminate between countries, it's a product-based measure. But I think, I guess there's a question of, you know, is aren't all tax measures essentially product based, and the common, you know, the least developed country exemption in the everything but arms is not, you know, is about the tariffs on products, and there's a different rate for lower income countries. So I just wonder if you could expand a bit on the thinking that went into why that wasn't, whether you saw that as an issue in the Paris Agreement and aligning with that, and again what was it that swayed you to feel that you could compensate countries in other ways with finance?
I can only repeat what I already said, that there is a completely different philosophy behind CBAM. We are just looking at the embedded emissions in specific goods. Therefore, the logic of the system is completely different. It's the external feature of a part of the scope of the ETS. And should I take the occasion to say that should from this spark any kind of green diplomacy, any kind of fruitful cooperation, that is always welcome. But those considerations, it was not a choice between different aspects. We had an issue and we had to solve it. And that was the solution for that. And for what concerns the WTO, I think we have in the Commission one of the longest standing negotiators in front of the WTO, who is in our legal service. And we have been reassured that that is not a tax, that is an environmental measure, because it is directly facing what is the emissions that are embedded. It's not a carbon tax, it's a certificate. And it's there to maintain the ambition that we have at EU level. It's a different philosophy. I guess only WTO, if challenged, could put an end to this debate. We can only say on which basis we have gone forward along that line, that road.
Thank you for elaborating. And the other one, which I think is more of a technical question, but an interesting one, is there's a couple of questions about how can you be sure that partner countries are reliably reporting on their emissions, and how will the CBAM treat different levels of carbon pricing? So I think that's just a practical question. If there's a lower carbon price in a partner country, will the CBAM look at the differential?
Of course. Yes, we have 3 years of a transitional period, exactly, because we intend to come with a slightly revised regulation before the entry into force of the definitive system, which is going to be in 2026. So we're going to give the possibility to use default values for the first two reports, which are until July of next year. But during the transitional period, there is not going to be any payment. This is only for us to check what would be the impact, but without any impact. And in the definitive phase, we would have verifiers that would go and verify emissions on site, so that it would be possible to check directly. This is not possible during the transitional period because we don't have the necessary legislative infrastructure to do that. But it's a bit of a difficult situation because we need to have the cooperation of those that are importing as much as possible in order to prepare for a definitive system in which we will have certainty about the emissions. So we cannot have it now, but whatever information we will have, that's going to be useful. And your second question was concerning the carbon price which is paid abroad. There are three things that have to be declared under CBAM. In the CBAM declaration is amount of goods, the amount of emissions embedded, and the carbon price already paid in the origin country. And of course, the offset will be only up to the level of the price that has been paid in the origin country. There is an automatic offset only for those countries that have an ETS that is automatically linked to ours, like Switzerland, for instance, or other EEA countries.
Great, thank you. I can't see any questions in the room. So what I'm going to do is bring us to some final comments from our panelists. And I wonder if I could encourage our panelists just to give us 30 seconds or 1 minute of final remarks. And if you haven't got something in mind, then I wonder what a nice way to frame this might be. What do you hope to see in the 3-year transition period from the CBAM? What would you really hope for? David, let me spring this on you first, and then give our online panelists a second, and I'll finish with you, Maria, if I may.
Well, I think I'd like to see greater international consensus, established lines of cooperation. For agreeing and also greater transparency for agreeing on all these issues. I think if that could be part of what the CBAM contributes to, I think that would help to take us towards dealing with, as you point out, Maria, the carbon leakages, but then also, of course, carbon leakages part of all contributing to the global ambition of reducing emissions and so on. But if we could move in that direction in a cooperative way without the diplomatic angst that has accompanied this, I think that would be a good thing.
Very nice and concise. Thank you. Rim.
Yes, so I think that as we saw during the discussion, the CBAM is truly a wake-up call for many nations that the time is ripe for more concerted and comprehensive decarbonization efforts. And it is likely the harbinger of tighter carbon regulation, standards, and taxes that could take various forms. So the sooner we start investigating how we can adapt and prepare for it, the better it will be.
Excellent. Thank you. David.
Yeah, perhaps two things. I think it would be wonderful if we saw more initiatives like the one on behalf of the Indian Ministry of Commerce in regard of export taxes in covered CBAM sectors. I think that would be extremely worried, from the Vietnamese Ministry of Commerce that is contemplating now to have a carbon mark, but also tax exports, in relation to carbon. And at the same time, the lawyer and me can't help myself but to wish for a legal challenge of the CBAM, which I think could be important to give it more also de jure legitimacy internationally to get the myth of CBAM WTO incompatibility sort of to debunk that myth. I think that would be both developments, I think, would be very helpful.
Great, that's a nice one. I appreciate that. And Maria, your last comment for you before we wrap up. What are your hopes for the 3 years?
Yes, thank you. I think that a successful CBAM is a CBAM that will no longer exist because we don't need it anymore. It would be wonderful if it would happen in 3 years. I'm afraid it will take a bit more time, but at least we started doing something.
Very good. I mean, mine's almost the opposite of yours in that, I mean, I think that, we won't achieve the transition to net zero without, a significant role for taxes and trade must play a part in that. It's clear that some big high income countries are not going to reduce their emissions voluntarily. And so trade, I think, will ultimately have to be the mechanism that's used to achieve that. And the CBAM, I think, is a great start on that. I'd like to see there being climate finance provided, in line with promises, but I take it that that's not a trade undertaking, but a wider one. So, look, thank you very much for this discussion. I think it's been great to get under the surface of the CBAM and its impacts and the responses. Thank you very much for joining us and for the questions online, and a particular thanks to Bruegel colleagues for arranging this event so seamlessly, and to my own CGD colleagues as well. So thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for more on CBAM.